You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 39 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Remember, if you haven't already, you can follow us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast, and also check out the Facebook page, facebook.com/Social Media and Politics Podcast. All right, y'all, thanks so much for tuning in. And if you're a new listener, welcome to the show. If you're into American politics or any type of electoral campaigning, today is your lucky day. You're going to love this episode. My guest is Dr. Daniel Kreese. He's an associate professor in the School of Media and Journalism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And he's recently written a book called Prototype Politics, Technology-Intensive Campaigning and the Data of Democracy. And this is all about how campaigns are using technology, how it's built up over time, and why digital media, data, and analytics are at the forefront of contemporary electoral dynamics. So in this interview, we're going to get into what's been going on in the Republican and Democratic parties for the past 15 to 20 years and kind of trace that up to where we are today. We're going to talk about the role of social media, micro-targeting, the election of Donald Trump, and then we're even going to look a bit ahead in terms of what's going on with regulation, do we need it, and why. Now, before cutting to the interview, I want to foreground a little bit what a campaign is. It's an organized effort to achieve some type of goal. Now, when we talk about political campaigns, we're generally talking about a politician or a party trying to get someone to vote. In the context of this podcast series, we're talking about a campaign that I'm working on trying to get 250 people to sign up for the Axios newsletter. So those who listened to the previous episode know what I'm talking about. There's basically a morning newsletter that gives you the top 10 stories of the day in terms of tech and politics, and it's a great newsletter. I know Dr. Kreese reads it because I see him tweeting about it, but we've already hit 50 signups, so still have about 200 to go, and I'm going to keep pushing this campaign until we get there, because if we get the 250, I can go have lunch with the founder, who's a previous Politico White House correspondent, and he started his own media company that's exclusively online, and I want to do a special 50th episode talking about the role of social media for journalism. So if you want to help out, and it's not going to happen unless you do, and I'm probably not going to stop talking about it unless you do, is click on the description for this episode. There'll be a link right there. Or go to socialmediaandpolitics.org, and there'll be a link right in the center of the page. And from there, all you do is put in your email, check out the newsletter. If you don't like it, unsubscribe. And if I can meet with these guys, I'm going to ask them to put the podcast in the newsletter. And then what's in it for you is that a little bit of press for the podcast will make it easier for me to get guests, and I can put out more episodes. So once again, just click the full description of this episode to find the link, or go to socialmediaandpolitics.org. That's the spirit of campaigning. And now I'm going to bring on Dr. Kreese to tell us all about how data and social media has been utilized in campaigning over the past two decades. My guest today is Dr. Daniel Kreese, associate professor in the School of Media and Journalism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and an affiliated fellow at the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. Dr. Kreese is one of the world's leading researchers exploring the role of data and technology in U.S. political campaigning, and his latest book, Prototype Politics, Technology-Intensive Campaigning and the Data of Democracy, is published by Oxford University Press. The book recently won the American Political Science Association's Best Book Award in Information Technology and Politics. Dr. Kreese, thanks so much for taking the time out, and welcome to the Social Media and Politics podcast.
Glad to be here.
So let's hop right into discussing prototype politics. My first question has to do with the subtitle. What does it mean to say that political campaigns are technology intensive?
Yeah, so one of the things that I wanted to point out in the book are the ways in which all of politics now has an underlying technological component to it that wasn't the case 30 years ago or even 20 years ago. And let me say a little bit more about what I mean by that. In terms of developing the idea of technology-intensive campaigning, I wanted to build off of Pippa Norris's framework, where she looked at the transition from labor-intensive campaigning, which was campaigning predicated on the politics of organization, large political parties, lots of boots on the ground, ways in which parties turn their voters out, to capital intensive campaigning, which she sort of documented as sort of the rise of the air wars, right? Mm-hmm. Expensive consultants, people who existed to purchase large advertising buys, that campaigns sort of vied for the public's attention and their hearts and minds through the airwaves. And what I think you've seen really in the last 20 years or so was a new shift, a shift towards technology intensive campaigning, one where the apparatuses that help elect candidates, at least in contemporary Western democracies, and particularly in my case in the United States, it's premised on large troves of databases made accessible through vast technological infrastructures that parties and campaigns and candidates work to maintain. And it really informs everything that candidates do. So when I say it's intensive, I mean it really provides the key organizing characteristic upon which all modern electoral contests, at least in the United States, is sort of predicated upon.
Mm-hmm. And when would you say that this all actually started? I mean, campaigns have developed to meet technological advancements, you know, throughout history. So is there a certain campaign or point in time that you consider a turning point for this real technology-intensive campaigning?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the great things about Norris's framework is that when she calls something labor-intensive or organizational-intensive, it doesn't mean that labor disappears in campaigns that come afterwards, or for my purposes, that capital for airwaves disappears in a technology-intensive era. What it means is that we see sort of a shift in kind, one where technology becomes the dominant characteristic that underlies all of modern electoral politics. So a couple of things that I really love, I mean, in your question is that, yeah, you know, data has long been a part of the way that electoral politics works, particularly in the United States. My favorite example was the ways in which William Jennings Bryan in the early 1900s maintained through the help of his wife and brother a massive index card file of all the supporters who were writing him letters to encourage him to, you know, stay active in politics, fight for the things that they believed in. And that card file eventually spanned to include over 250,000 names. And from these letters, his brother and wife gleaned everything from things such as religious affiliation to political identity, issues that people cared about, occupation, et cetera. And Bryan used this vast card file to activate his supporters when he was running. You know, fast forward to the mid-90s, and I think what you see is that these basic files start to come online, get organized in these new databases, taking advantage of new technologies in ways that become much more actionable and much more usable for campaigns up and down ballot, and that start to get maintained by political parties in a much more organized fashion. So if I had a point to sort of a moment when campaigns start to enter this technology-intensive era, I'd really look to the mid-1990s, when the Republican Party in the U.S. developed the Voter Vault, which was the first real national voter database maintained by a U.S. political party. It had records on all members of the electorate. It was compiled from various forms of public data made available by secretaries of state, and really sort of became something that the party was actively involved in cleaning and maintaining and carrying forward from election cycle to election cycle and making available to its candidates up and down ballot. Now, from that mid-1990s period to today, we've seen leaps and bounds in voter database technology and technologies that have made these voter files more actionable in ways that campaigns have used their voter files and merged it with other forms of data, such as commercial marketing data, social media data, internet data more broadly. And that really provides the premise for everything that campaigns do today in a way that simply was not the case in the 1980s. So, for instance, if campaigns are going to run advertisements to members of the electorate, it starts by developing a universe of people using this voter database technology and analytics on top of it that creates certain defined targets in terms of who campaigns want to reach and what they want to say. And then that basic database and those scores of people they want to reach then get purchased through things like cable set-top box data, where they figure out then which people are going to be likely to be tuning in to which television programs at which moments in the day, and how do we target them with certain messages that would likely be persuasive. And I think another big characteristic of the technology-intensive era, really since the 1990s, is that the technological apparatuses that help elect candidates are no longer understandable to the candidates themselves. And I think that this is a really key shift. So if you think about earlier eras of labor-intensive campaigning, candidates often were involved in at least the basic knowledge of the party apparatus that was hitting the streets to help them get elected, the different coalitions that went into that. If you think about the air wars, candidates were often involved in making at least editorial decisions in terms of the advertisements that were running in order to elect them, basic advertising strategies, the people they needed to reach. But in the modern era, the contemporary era, really, where we are today, candidates often have no idea or understanding of the voter databases, the complex sets of arrangements that take shape underneath them in terms of data sharing between different entities, the infrastructures that exist across many different platforms maintained by many different companies and political entities that exist to help them get elected. And I think a really great example of this is after the 2016 election in the United States, when Hillary Clinton, you know, said that she inherited nothing from the Democratic Party when it came to data, which was completely untrue. And I think revealed really the ways in which infrastructures have now grown infinitely more complex in ways that candidates just simply don't understand.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about those infrastructures in a second, but I think it's interesting. Did you say that it was the Republicans who first invented these voter files?
Absolutely, yeah. So starting really in the mid-90s with a Republican national voter database called Voter Vault, that was a key innovation of electoral politics at the time. It was the first truly national voter file, and Republicans were far out in front of the Democrats when it came to voter data and voter data technology, really until 2005, 2006, with the Democratic Party and their elected chair, Howard Dean, who modernized the Democratic Party for the first time.
Yeah, it's interesting. We usually think of Democrats as having the upper hand on technology and innovation, which is an interesting point, I think, which is this idea of prototype campaigns, which I'm assuming that's where the title of the book comes from, that there are certain innovations and developments that certain campaigns enact, and then they become a prototype that drives further innovation. So can you discuss the relationship between prototype campaigns and innovation?
Yeah. So one of the things that I set out to do in this book was to think about why is it that we see certain innovative campaigns? Why are certain campaigns more innovative than others? What explains why, at least to American audiences, you know, everyone could point to the Howard Dean campaign in 2004 and say that was innovative. Everyone could point to Obama's 2008 run as the first campaign to really use social media and say that was innovative. What explains how innovation on campaigns takes shape? And then what explains when it actually gets adopted by other members of the field or when it doesn't? So those were the two things I really set out to explain. On the first question, sort of what makes for an innovative campaign, we found, and here not only in my book, but some of the subsequent work that I've done with my colleague Adam Saffer, that we actually looked at the teams of individuals who ended up working on campaigns. And we built a unique data set in politics where we identified every single staffer who's worked in technology, digital media, data, or analytics on every Republican and Democratic primary and general election campaign from 2004 to 2012. Now we've updated it for 2016. And then what we did is after we compiled this list of 629 staffers, we used public data sources to identify their entire careers. So we were able to actually track what sorts of people were working in politics, what sorts of backgrounds and skills did they have, what fields did they come from. And drawing on the work of scholars such as David Stark and Woody Powell, organizational sociologists, We tested the idea that innovation would be likely to arise when people came into the political field from other sectors. So to give one great example, Chris Hughes, one of the co-founders of Facebook, who took a leave of absence from the company to join the Obama campaign in 2008. The idea is that people who cross professional fields will bring with them a different way of practicing, a different way of understanding politics that would ultimately give rise to innovation. And we've set out to test this. And in fact, what we found is that campaigns where practitioners themselves identify as being innovative, so Dean, Obama, for instance, generally have higher levels of diversity when it comes in the context of these field crossers. And oftentimes, such as on the Dean and the Obama campaigns, these are people who are coming out of the tech sector. They often tended to be young in their 20s. They were leaving high-tech jobs in places like Silicon Valley or other urban startup cultures around the United States. They took a leave of absence from their careers for various reasons. They either believed in a candidate or, you know, they believed that it was time to apply their skills to politics, or they wanted a challenge of sort of remaking democracy in the way that campaigns were run, and they entered politics. And what we found is that they actually were quite successful at transforming the ways that campaigns were run in new ways. So to just take two of those examples, the Howard Dean campaign was really noteworthy and has been very well documented in the literature. But, you know, it was really the first campaign to take up proto-social networking tools to engage supporters. They crowdsourced a lot of their electoral operations, such as volunteer ops, as well as doing online fundraising in a systematic way for the first time. They pioneered the use of email in the political space. The Obama team in 2008, of course, came along and improved on what Dean did, gave it more structure and organization, was the first to really use Facebook as a concerted organizing tool at that moment in time. And all of which was driven, again, by the diversity of the folks who were working on these bids and the fact that so many of them were coming from outside the political field and bringing with them new ways of doing things. In terms of the second question is then, well, when does innovation actually get taken up in the political field? The argument for prototypes is that some campaigns can do things in a new and different way, but they only become truly transformative of a field when other actors collectively point to them and see them as disclosing a new way of running electoral political campaigns in a way that's politically efficacious. So to give you an example to this, Howard Dean's campaign was highly innovative, but it only became a prototype that disclosed a new way of doing things that subsequently transformed the way that Democratic Party campaigns were run when John Kerry lost the 2004 election. Because it was that moment when the party collectively said, "We lost an election that we believed we should have won," that the party looked to other models to do things differently, looked at the Dean campaign and said, "This campaign was a prototype that we can subsequently take up elements of." And indeed, I chart the growth of entrepreneurial startups in the Democratic Party by members of that campaign in the months and years after that election cycle, and show that Dean's former staffers were vastly influential at creating new consultancies that then in turn institutionalized a lot of the innovations on the Dean campaign and carried it forward to other sites in electoral politics. The point is that none of that would have actually happened if John Kerry didn't lose that election and the party as a whole collectively sort of determined that they needed a new way of doing things. Indeed, there were other campaigns that were deeply innovative, but their innovations were never clearly taken up. George Bush's bid in 2004 is a great example of this. George Bush really created a lot of innovations when it came in the context of using voter data, mobilizing supporters, melding internet and field operations. However, the party won an election at that moment in time. And all sorts of institutional factors really worked against Bush's innovations being carried forward in the party. In 2008, the Republican Party expected to lose because they saw Obama as being this transformational candidate and running sort of in a deeply economic and politically favorable context. So when McCain lost, the Republican Party never sought out new models or even looked to the Obama campaign as disclosing a new way of engaging in electoral politics. And as a result, they were never taken up. Those innovations were never taken up in the Republican Party until 2012.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, you know, there's a kind of penchant to look at Obama 2008 and say, look, that was an innovative campaign. He won. But I think you go a step kind of behind the curtain and say that actually failed campaigns can deliver this type of self-reflection that can be introspective and lead to innovation. I think that's a very interesting point.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, the flip side on that, too, is also that, you know, it's not as if there's one evolutionary path towards innovation and the uptake of innovations. But the context that's cultural has to be right. So the stories that people in parties tell themselves after elections about why they won or lost really matter. So again, to go back to the Republican example in 08, because party leaders and a broader network of consultancies and activists in the Republican Party could say John McCain was going to lose anyway, there was no incentive or urgency for them to look at what Obama did differently and well, and therefore take up those innovations in the Republican Party. Fast forward 4 years in 2012, there was a very different story for Republicans after Mitt Romney lost. And indeed, the party then looked to the Obama campaign in 12 and said, we need to get better when it comes to technology and organizing. And that was one key reason why Romney lost and Obama won. And therefore, you start to see massive investments in the Republican Party, the support for new entrepreneurial startups built around data and digital and politics, the new investment in voter databases, et cetera. So what really matters, and I think the theoretical point here, is that it's perceptions, collective perceptions by certain entities that really matter for technological innovation and adoption.
Super interesting. And speaking of innovation, I have a question about the database that you built of digital strategists and pulling public data about their previous careers. Is that something that you took out of the page of a campaign? Like, did your field work inform that idea? It seems like something a political campaign would do, right? Like in terms of micro-targeting. So I'm just curious.
To be honest, I don't remember where the insight first came from. I think I was playing around on this. There's this great site for U.S. politics called Democracy in Action. It's this nonprofit, nonpartisan website that just compiles like FEC data and public reports about who works for campaigns. And I think right around that time, I became very interested. I was reading a lot of organizational sociology, and I just became very interested in like people's biographies and their work histories and backgrounds, which sort of led us to start building this data set that was, you know, compiling the full work histories of all these people. It turns out that it's gotten a ton of attention in political spaces because nobody had ever really thought to do it before. But it really reveals, I think, a lot of the ways precisely what you're saying is that politics works, which is, you know, in the U.S. at least, a lot of the people who work in politics and a lot of the jobs that they get are premised on relationships and network ties. So people who work together in one campaign context before, after that campaign's done, go on to do other things. And then when it comes time to staff a new campaign, they, of course, turn to people that they've worked with before, people who have like good reputations in certain social circles. So it kind of made perfect sense at that moment in time to sort of say, well, we could study this from a network perspective and think about what are the broader structures of the two U.S. political parties in ways that sort of reveal these underlying network components, but also helps us map things like innovation.
Yeah, super interesting. And throughout the book, speaking of networks and infrastructures, which you've alluded to a bit already, there's a central focus in the book, not just on the political parties, but exactly what you're saying, their party networks and the infrastructural elements of a party that are built up over time. And that, you know, is things like staffers, but also hired firms and data services. Can you explain a little bit the idea of party networks and outline some of the major differences between Democrats and Republicans in the last, say, 15 years or so?
Yeah, so this is a great question. I come at this from two angles. So really, over the last 5 or 6 years or so, a number of scholars, including Michael Heaney, have started to reconceptualize political parties as networks. So networks of not only people in government and elected officials, but also activists and donors and civil society organizations working on particular issues, and even highly active members of the electorate. And this comes in the context of trying to figure out, well, what shapes the outcomes of primary contests? And one of the arguments that scholars of party networks will say is that parties decide the outcome of party contests, but parties are not simply the elites that we used to think about before, but actually different networks of activists who are joined together in sort of loose coalition to promote certain interests and certain outcomes, depending on sort of how they're situated. The thing that I really brought to the table from my own background in science and technology studies and building on the work of people like Bruno Latour is to say, we can actually extend out the idea of networks to go even a little farther to actually include technologies and artifacts themselves. So in my own particular domain, which has always been more in sort of the tech and politics, you get a sense of not only things like digital consultancies or staffers who have worked for, you know, certain tech firms, but also the actual technologies themselves that they're using and how they're maintained through different entities. And that you can actually start to map in a more expansive way, one that includes both humans and non-humans, to also take into account of things like voter databases and interfaces, you know, proprietary campaign technologies maintained by certain firms. And you could start to think about networks as more expansive even than just sort of this group of activists and donors and party elites, et cetera, to actually include things like voter databases. So that was sort of the analytical move that I sort of made in my book. And then the next sort of step beyond that was to say, can we actually map out the ways in which networks of the two parties have changed and evolved over time? When it comes to technological artifacts, one of the core arguments of the 2016 book, Prototype Politics, but also my previous book, Taking Our Country Back, which stopped in with the 2008 Obama campaign, is that central to the Democratic Party's electoral success was the emergence really of a defined network of individuals that came out of the Dean campaign and then went on to important positions within the Democratic Party and then the Obama 2008 campaign, and then the ways in which a group of technological artifacts traveled with them and gave shape to those campaigns that we now consider sort of revolutionary and groundbreaking. So, you know, an example is that we found that coming out of the Dean campaign in 2004, there were a number of different entrepreneurial ventures, including a firm called Blue State Digital, which is now a really prominent Democratic firm that provides basic email infrastructure for up and down ballot campaigns. It's one of the market leaders in Democratic politics. Two of their founders joined Chairman Dean at the Democratic Party, where Howard Dean commissioned the firm to build a technology, a voter engagement platform called Party Builder. And then it was the Democratic Party's investment in Blue State Digital's tools that then became the basis for my.barackobama.com, which powered the 2008 campaign. So what you see is this melding, this network emerge of organizations, individuals, and artifacts that take shape over time and that become part of the infrastructure that the Obama 2008 campaign was able to draw on when Obama ran for president in 2008. And as somebody who was really running from behind from all the institutional support that Hillary Clinton had, it was a key sort of competitive advantage that helped him really sort of pull even with a much better resource Clinton campaign in 2008. The story that I tell in Prototype Politics is to really chart the differences in the Republican and Democratic parties' extended networks, specifically in the context of technological expertise, their staffers, data, and tools from this period of 2004 to 2014, which is where I ended the study of that book. And some of the key differences that, you know, that I found was that based on the fact that the Dean campaign became this prototype that was subsequently transformative of the Democratic Party network, what you found on the Democratic side of the aisle was a much deeper bench of staffers with expertise who were being hired onto these campaigns. And with that came a much deeper commitment to things such as hiring technology, digital media, data and analytics staffers onto Democratic campaigns up and down ballot. So you saw 527 Democratic staffers hired from the period of 04 to 2012, compared with 127 Republican staffers. So massive differences in hiring at this moment in time. We charted rates of entrepreneurship, and we found that just Democrats had much higher rates of new organizational founding compared to Republicans during the same time period. And what happens within that is that, you know, Democratic new ventures and consultants, what they're doing is they're institutionalizing campaign technologies that come out of well-resourced campaigns and carrying them forward from election cycle to election cycle. So from 2004 to May 2014, we found that Democratic staffers founded 67 different firms and organizations, compared with only 15 firms and organizations on the Republican side of the aisle at that moment in time. And oftentimes, those organizations, those new ventures, which were oftentimes consultancies, were in turn building new technologies and tools that were transforming the infrastructure that Democratic Party campaigns had available to them in future election cycles and future efforts. The Republican Party during this time period underwent a very different sort of moment in time in terms of their party network, largely because during 04, Bush was reelected. There was little urgency to sort of rethink the basic electoral systems they had in place. During the 2008 campaign, as I mentioned earlier, John McCain lost an election that pretty much everyone on the Republican aisle side of the aisle expected him to lose. So there's little urgency to sort of rethink things, to pick up on the Obama campaign's innovations. It was only in 2012, and this is where my book ends up, when Romney lost an election that Republican operatives believed that they should have won, that you start to see new ventures get created. New staffers get hired from the technology industry into the Republican Party, and new innovations start to get taken up in a way that Trump benefited from when he became the nominee in the summer of 2016 and was able to inherit a lot of the Republican Party apparatus that was built after 2012.
Yeah, and that makes me think about the role of the party, which seems to emerge as something that is super critical for a campaign. Like these services, the party networks, they're built up over time. They're sent down to down ballot races. I mean, if you're an independent candidate, you don't have access to that years and years of technology. How do you compete? So do you think that this is a positive development, this kind of building up the party network, building up the infrastructures? Because it seems to coalesce a lot of power around the party and their selected candidates.
Yeah. So my normative take on this might be different from some of your listeners. But look, I think that Julia Azari, a political scientist, put this brilliantly to say that at least in the United States, we are in an era of strong partisanship and weak parties. And what she means by that is that in the electorate, people have very strong partisan identifications and party attachments, such that even in an extraordinary election like 2016 in the United States, 90% of Democrats voted for Hillary Clinton and 90% of Republicans voted for Donald Trump. So partisanship, partisan identity really trumps all. However, Azari's other point was that parties are actually really weak in the context that they're not able to control their own nomination contests. Now, what Julia was speaking of was just the ways in which Donald Trump could capture the Republican Party nomination really without any institutional party support. So that parties, in essence, couldn't control who would become their standard bearers. Now, why this is of concern to a lot of political scientists, and I would include myself among them, is to say parties serve a very important function of putting politics and nominees through the lens of institutional expertise and institutional concerns, right? So the good thing that parties do is that they are broad coalitions of many different interests. And to the extent that parties have to broker between their many different coalitions, and at the end of the day have a commitment to governing and a governing that's based on compromise, people who can come from the outside, such as demagogues, can subvert that process and make direct appeals to the voters. And I think this is one of the global issues that we're seeing today with the rise of populism. Populism is taking place outside of standard party structures, and it's working to undermine those party structures. And it's doing so in a way where different insurgent non-institutional candidates are making direct appeals to voters, and they're able to sort of work entirely outside of the normal political, professional, political expertise, coalitional politics concern that traditional parties have. So all of which is a very complicated way of saying that I believe that control over party databases and extended party networks of expertise and resources is one of the few institutional points of leverage that political candidates, political parties sort of still have, and something that cuts against political amateurism and people making outside appeals to voters. Donald Trump, I think, was at least in the U.S. context, a unique candidate in that one of the reasons for his success really came through his command of mass media and his ability to use new platforms such as Twitter to appeal directly to the Republican primary electorate. And he did all these things without piecing together a conventional campaign organization and one that would have really been premised on exactly the sorts of technological and data infrastructures that I chronicle in my book. I think one of the big questions that we have going forward is Donald Trump an outlier, or does he represent something new in terms of a blend of celebrity and populist politics that empowers people to go entirely outside of regular institutional party structures? But to answer your question, I would say that from a normative perspective, I think parties need to be more involved and not less in controlling their party nominations, precisely because one of the important things they do is they serve as a voice of moderation and a check on populism in terms of enabling people to come from the outside like a Donald Trump and appeal to partisan passions and things like xenophobia in the United States and in contemporary Europe as well. And I think that one of the things that technology does is help political parties maintain some control over their nomination processes. So if you look at the Democratic Party, for instance, you know, they have rules over who can access their voter databases. And as you point out, the vast store of data built up over time and the electoral advantages that that would offer. One of the things that that does is it rewards incumbents as opposed to challengers. And it rewards institutional Democrats as opposed to people coming from the outside. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing from the perspective of democracy, because parties are the way that democracies are organized.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting that the tech can kind of help the incumbent, but it can also help challengers as well. So it's an interesting dynamic there. But I want to pick your brain about one more thing, which is you've done all this work charting the innovations and changes in American campaigning in the past couple election cycles. Was there one aspect of innovation or change, a big thing or a small thing, that really stuck out for you as like a aha, that was smart?
Yeah, I mean, I think really, I mean, if you look historically, I think it's something that I mentioned before, which is the Republican Party's efforts and success at building the first national voter database and interface system for accessing it in the mid to late 1990s. And their ability to make that available to candidates up and down the aisle has to mark as sort of the big innovation that's now been taken up in both political parties and forms the core of every single thing that modern campaigns do. So, you know, when they buy advertising, it's premised on analytics that's run on top of these national voter files that both parties maintain. When campaigns do digital advertising, when they think about organic posts and what they're going to message to audiences on Facebook, when they target individuals through cable set-top boxes, when they plan candidate visits or they open field offices, all of this is premised on these national voter files that are maintained in time by both political parties and made actionable through voter database interfaces, as well as analytics platforms that help political practitioners take it up in politics. I think that those that has to be the big innovation that's driven all these technology-intensive developments since then.
Right. And, you know, I think there's been a lot of discussion about social media and micro-targeting, which is kind of an artifact that's the targeting, at least, has developed out of those voter databases. They're critical for all the work that that's done on social media. So I want to zero in on that and ask you, where does social media fit into this larger party network infrastructural machine? What's the role of social media, and has it been a game changer for campaigns?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So one of the things that you can sort of track is that there's two kind of different developments that run in tandem throughout the history that I tell in Prototype Politics. So on the one hand, you see this rise of national voter files that both U.S. political parties are maintaining and the data that underlies them. On the other is sort of this increasing attention to digital media in the context of communications and messaging. And those two histories meet at certain points along the way, so in ways that become very consequential. So the first is really innovations of like Howard Dean's campaign in terms of figuring out for his candidate that like you can message directly to voters now using digital media and these proto social networking sites, because it wasn't really social networks or social media yet in 2004. But that you could message in those ways. And then it was sort of figuring out that you could use digital media in a way to help you build your voter databases. So you could capture people's emails, for instance. And once people could be an email, you could link that email to their record in a voter file. And then you could start to ask them to do things for campaigns, right? So you would want to get volunteers to help you to go door to door and canvass. You would want to use an email to drive small dollar donations to your campaigns. Fast forward to 2008 and 2012, and what you start to see is that campaigns now are using those national voter files in a way to start doing things like digital advertising, which has grown by leaps and bounds across the 2008, 2012, and 2016 cycle. So in 2016, for instance, when campaigns were looking to use social media to run targeted advertising, the first thing that they start is by looking at their voter file, figuring out which voters are we going to try to reach, how are we going to try to reach them, what are going to be the most effective messaging to reach out to them. And then what they're doing is they're buying custom audiences on platforms like Facebook, you know, given whatever match rate they have, but and then advertising directly to those audiences, and then trying to convert those audiences into people who are going to give an email address over to the campaign or are going to give donations or get involved by volunteering in particular ways. So what you see over time is really a melding of social media data to these national voter file data, and integration is a really huge issue that I spend a lot of time talking about in my book, but trying to figure out ways in which that you could start gleaning more data from social media about what people care about, who are going to be your engaged supporters, how do I reach them on a regular basis, and using social media strategies in a ways that are generating data back to campaigns, but also complementing what campaigns are doing when it comes to things like field operations and fundraising. But that's not all that social media is used for. And I think the other, again, to sort of go back to the track metaphor, campaigns have sort of also been taking up social media in other ways that have been very effective. So I write a lot about in the book how Twitter, for instance, during 2012, became for the first time a platform used by candidates to set the agenda and the frames of the professional press. One of the features of technology-intensive campaigning is that it's constantly changing as the technologies of everyday life themselves are changing from cycle to cycle. So there might be entirely new platforms that spring up in between the 4 years between a presidential election, but also platforms themselves are always changing. There's new algorithms that are being launched. Algorithms are changing, which shape visibility and attention among audiences. So campaigns constantly have to be figuring out sort of how are things changing and how are audiences interacting with content in new ways. And Twitter is really this story. When I started doing prototype politics, I remember it was really in 12, after Obama had just been elected, and I had this moment of panic. And I was like, did I write about Twitter in my book that stopped in the 2008 election? Because Twitter was the center of the political universe in 2012. And yet I barely remembered writing about it in a book that covered, you know, Obama's first election victory. And I found that there was like one mention of Twitter, and it was in a footnote. And the digital director, new media director at the time, was the nomenclature. Joe Rospers, you know, said to me that he didn't even remember who ran their Twitter feed in 2008. That it, you know, it was an intern or somebody in the basement of Chicago headquarters. You know, fast forward 4 years to 12, and Twitter is absolutely at the center of the political universe and used as a very key way that candidates were setting the agenda of the professional press. And that very much kept up in 2016. So social media becomes a platform, at least Twitter, in terms of appealing to the professional press. On Facebook, you know, campaigns have figured out that that's the general interest medium. It's the platform that everyone is on, and everyone is on all the time, from high schoolers to people's grandmothers. And that became the general interest way that campaigns were going to try to speak directly to voters, but even more importantly, engage their supporters in producing organic content that was going to get a lot of engagement and be shared through new digital two-step flows to wider members of the electorate. So it becomes a communications mechanism in not simple ways that are about targeted communication, but in ways that are involved in setting the agenda of the public by working through opinion leaders and working through social information flows on things like social media. Even as Twitter becomes an important vehicle for speaking to political elites and specifically political journalists. And even in that time, we've seen new technologies like Snapchat, for instance, became a key way that campaigns reach out and try to speak to different audiences, such as younger voters. So, you know, using social media, not just for targeted communication, but also for broad communications designed to reach sort of different non-paid audiences through rhetorically effective action.
Yeah. And I have two last questions for you that we've been talking about social media in terms of how campaigns use it as a communication tool, a data tool. But these are things that are, you know, through the platform. But you've done some work looking at the relationships between Facebook representatives and Google representatives, for example, with campaigns. Can you talk to that a little bit as to, apart from campaigns actually using the platforms themselves, how is their relationship with the actual representatives from those companies?
Yeah, so this is really my big new area of research and a book that I'm currently working on with my colleague Shannon McGregor at the University of Utah and Adam Saffer in my school. But one of the things that we sort of found as a byproduct of conducting campaign interviews with digital and social media directors from the 16 cycle was the degree to which they were in touch on a regular basis with representatives of companies such as Facebook and Google and Twitter. They were very routine resources that helped them do everything from use their platforms effectively to helping them implement and execute things like paid digital advertising buys. So let me say a little bit more about sort of how this works. And we've discovered through subsequent research that Facebook, Twitter, and Google, to take three examples, all have dedicated partisan teams. So in the United States, these teams are organized on the same grounds as the political field. So there's a group of Democratic Facebook staffers and Republican Facebook staffers. These individuals are often recruited from the campaign worlds. So they actually come up in politics, whether it's Democratic or Republican politics, and then they get recruited onto Facebook. And what these staffers do is they serve as liaisons to political campaigns themselves. And they do a couple of different things. One is sort of this routine troubleshooting role that they provide. So the social media manager for Marco Rubio, for instance, right, talked extensively about how if she was having issues doing something like embedding video, or if she had seen something that like a brand was doing on Facebook and wanted to do something similar, she would have a liaison within Facebook that she can ask those questions of. How do I do that, right? Sometimes campaigns would reach out to their companies to help them understand changes in the algorithm, right? So one of the features of Facebook is that the algorithm is constantly changing in terms of what content gets the most reach and engagement. So for campaigns, right, they're reading lots of social media marketing literature to try to discern these changes. But in the middle of an election campaign, which is a very delimited amount of time, they have to be very responsive in the moment because any change could ultimately affect how well their content performs and ultimately mean hundreds of thousands of fewer dollars in something like campaign fundraising. So they could reach out to their liaisons to help them figure out what are the changes in the algorithm? What content's going to perform best, et cetera? And then there's a lot of really in-house consulting, which is how Shannon and I describe this, from Facebook and Google and Twitter about how to best utilize their platform for ad sales. And I think this takes us back to something we discussed earlier, which is that, you know, Donald Trump was a huge beneficiary from the in-house resources that firms such as Facebook, Google, and Twitter provide to the campaign field, in part because he had very little in the way of a traditional campaign staff that was going to help him do things like execute advertising buys on Facebook. So one of the places where my book leaves off is that after Romney's loss, the Republican Party had invested millions of dollars in sort of building up its database and interface infrastructure, getting better voter data, getting more expertise and skills into the party. The ironic thing is that the candidate who wins and emerges from the nomination process is precisely the one who has the least amount of traditional campaign infrastructure at all. So what Trump did as a candidate was relied very heavily on the RNC and the in-house expertise and data that the RNC had. The RNC, in turn, turned around, and one of the ways that it made up from its own small staff compared to a Hillary Clinton campaign that had over 234 staffers in-house alone in digital data, tech, and analytics, was to outsource a lot of their operations to Facebook and to Google and Twitter to say, look, we have $70 million in the Trump case that we want to spend on digital, and you're going to help us facilitate those advertising buys. So we're going to tell you broadly who we want to reach, but you're going to help us figure out how are we going to appeal to them? What else should we be doing? What sorts of messages should we be doing? How do we optimize our ads to get the highest rates of engagement? And you're going to help us execute that. So they outsourced a lot of their campaign organization to these firms themselves. Now, the firms themselves were more than happy to do this because they get paid on the basis of the rates of engagement their advertising gets. That's one of the hallmarks of digital advertising. So if the Trump team was going to say, we're going to spend this amount of money and this is going to be our budget, the firms have all the incentive in the world to help maximize their own share going to their own companies by producing high-performing ads and optimizing those ads in the political space. And one of the things that we really found is that Clinton did a lot of this stuff in-house because she had the team to do it, whereas the very short-staffed Trump team and the RNC that was really keeping him afloat sort of very wisely realized that they could turn to the companies themselves to help them maximize their digital advertising and their buys, and that these firms were more than happy to do so. And really, I think that's the big story of the 2016 election, is that the Trump team treated Facebook, Google, and Twitter much like a lot of big brands treat these companies, which is to say they bring their advertising budgets to these firms. These firms make available to them these creative teams and these back-end data and analytics teams that help them utilize their platforms for advertising, because there's a lot of revenue at stake in the political field, but also in the commercial field, that provides monetary incentives for these companies to engage in these sorts of activities.
Which is super interesting in terms of what we were talking about before and the party networks and the party structure. It seems that the RNC and the Trump campaign kind of use that external expertise that hadn't actually been built up to such an extent in the party that it was at Facebook and Twitter. Obviously, they know their platforms better, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that's the key point, is that, look, Facebook, Google, and Twitter know their platforms better than anyone else and can provide, you know, inside level sort of advice about how to best navigate them. For the companies, they have a bunch of incentives, right? They want their platforms to be used well by campaigners, particularly in very high profile, high salience elections. They get revenue from it, the process, but they also create relationships with people in the political field that, you know, might help further on down the line to buy the company's goodwill when it comes to questions of things such as regulation. But I think the other key part that you notice is that what I really love about the party network's perspective is that it's flexible enough to not presume in advance that we know who are political actors and who are not. Right. So I think one of the things that Shannon and I very clearly show in our article is that you can now consider these partisan teams to be part of party networks, in that they're actively working on behalf of a particular candidate, albeit doing so within a commercial technology firm. But they are part of the resources and skills that candidates have to build off of in the course of an election, and therefore should be considered part of the resource base of a party network, and one that candidates bring to the table.
Which leads very well to my final question, picking up on two points you mentioned. One is that it's in the best interests of the platforms to have good relationships with campaigns, because if that candidate goes into office, then that person pulls the levers of regulation, so to speak. And also external actors. So here we're talking about Facebook and Twitter representatives, but I'm thinking more about, you know, malicious external actors like Russian trolls. So do you think that the recent controversy around Russian interference in U.S. democracy, in part on social media platforms, do you think that relationship between politicians and the platforms has changed? And where do you see it going from here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, my own perspective on this is that these technology firms are facing a unprecedented political and legitimacy crisis, at least in U.S. contexts. I think that, you know, Silicon Valley tech firms for a very long time have enjoyed, I think, goodwill from the political field, but also from a lot of members of the public. I think that has been eroded in the aftermath of the 2016 election, when it was quite clear that they themselves did not anticipate the ways in which external actors and strategic actors could undermine the flows of discourse or manipulate the flows of discourse on their platforms. So the question is sort of, what do I see happening? I think that one of the reasons why Facebook, Google, and Twitter are in this position right now is actually a failure to act as an institution. And here I'm sort of drawing off of you know, classic institutional accounts of you know, the press as an institution, one that developed common ethical guidelines, standards, practices, routines, ways of working. I think the tech field has largely failed to do that thus far. And that has meant that really all three of these big firms have sort of been acting on their own and yet facing common threats. or common sort of political and other issues. So one of the things that I do think that we'll see in the wake of the 2016 cycle in the US and the recent hearings on Capitol Hill is that I think you'll see much more in tandem sort of responses from Facebook, Google, and Twitter to these issues around the manipulation of discourse on their platforms. I think you'll see more standardization in the way that they require things like transparency and disclosure, not only of the identities of people on their platforms, but also for things like paid strategic communications. And I think that they'll much more sort of act in tandem to create certain guidelines for speech and discourse on their platforms, all of which up to this point they've largely been pursuing independently. I think those things will start to take shape. In terms of regulation, I think 99% of this is going to be driven by Europe and, you know, Germany in particular, which has much stricter oversight and scrutiny of these firms on privacy and other grounds than in the United States. I don't see a contemporary U.S. Republican Party with a taste for regulation, even of these social media firms, and even in the wake of unprecedented questions of democratic legitimacy. I just don't really foresee that happening. I think self-regulation will continue to be the norm in the United States. I continue to see the Federal Election Commission, which is our main governing body of election law, to continue to be deadlocked and paralyzed. So I don't really see much happening in that boat. What I would say is that it's going to be regulatory questions and debates that happen in Europe that will downstream sort of affect the way that social media companies run their platforms around elections in places like the United States.
Definitely something to keep an eye out on, but I think we'll end here with a good preface of where we are today, and where we go forward is only time will tell. But Dr. Kreese, thank you so much for taking the time out. It's been super insightful.
This is great. Thanks.
I've just been speaking with Dr. Daniel Kreese, Associate Professor in the School of Media and Journalism at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. If you like the topics we were talking about today, go pick up a copy of his book, Prototype Politics, Technology-Intensive Campaigning and the Data of Democracy. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, go swing by socialmediaandpolitics.org, click on the referral link, and sign up for the Axios newsletter. Thanks again for tuning in, and remember, you can follow us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast. Check out the Facebook page, Social Media and Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.